Welcome to Heartline. I'm Rita Schulte, a licensed therapist in the Northern Virginia, D.C. area, and I'm passionate about matters of the heart. I want to check the pulse on your heart by taking a look at some of the cutting-edge issues that are affecting you and the people around you, and have you consider, how in the world is all this mess called life affecting your heart? To help stir things up, we're going to be talking to some of the leading professionals in the Christian counseling and literary industry, as well as hosting discussions with real people who are struggling with real life issues. If you want to know a little bit about me, check me out at ritaschulte.com. That's S-C-H-U-L-T-E.com, where you can ask questions, find out about my book, listen to other podcasts, or request to be a guest on the show. You can also find me on Facebook at Rita Schulte LPC or follow me on Twitter at Heartline Pod. So let's get going on this journey of the heart. April 5th, 2013 is a day that forever changed the life of Rick and Kay Warren. Their beloved son Matthew took his life after a long battle with depression. I share a common bond with the Warrens today. Last November, my husband and soulmate took his life, and my world, just like theirs, was totally decimated. I'm joining hands with the Warrens in their commitment to spread the word about mental illness, in the sincere hope that we can educate, equip, and empower the church toward greater understanding and compassion for those who suffer with a mental health disorder. Kay, welcome to Heartline.
Thank you.
Your life as you knew it was left in ruins last April when your son took his life. And you've said there were moments that you felt like you couldn't even take your next breath. And those moments don't go away after the shock and enormity of a tragedy like this, you know, wear off. They can last for months, even years. Can you talk about what you needed most in those first few months from other people? What was helpful and what wasn't?
People just letting me talk. I needed both. I needed people who would let me talk, and I needed people who could let me be silent and were comfortable with my silence. I needed people to not minimize. I know that people try to be comforting. I mean, we all do. We all try to comfort somebody else who's in sorrow, and there's some little nifty phrases that we use, like at least, and they would, sometimes people would say, well, at least you know he's in heaven. And that's true, but I wanted him here. Or they would say, at least you had him for 27 years.
Oh.
That's true, but I wanted him a lot longer. At least you knew where his body was, because sometimes in war and tragedy, you know, something, bodies are, I mean, let's be honest, sometimes bodies are blown up or they're lost in the sea and people don't have it. And so they would say, so at least you have his body. And I would think, yes, you're right. But I want, it just all boils down to, it's a way of minimizing, trying to put grief into a more containable box instead of, so that it's not so overwhelming. And you know what? Catastrophic grief is overwhelming, and there's nothing you can do to make it not overwhelming. And I needed people to let me be and express how overwhelmed I was at Matthew's death. At the same time, I needed occasionally people to just let me be silent. We're in a small group, Rick and I, and we've been together for about 12 years with these four couples. And I remember some of the first times we got back together as a group, I couldn't talk. I couldn't enter in. I wanted to be with these people that I loved, but I couldn't even move my mouth. And I remember one group, I wrapped myself up in a blanket. We were sitting outside, and I wrapped myself up in a blanket, kind of pulled it over my head, and I slept. And I said, please keep talking. Please keep just interacting. I mean, you don't mind me. Mm-hmm. This is what I need. I want to be close to you, but I can't talk. And they let me do that. And they were comfortable with the silence. So I needed both. I needed interaction, and I needed just people's presence with me.
And I think it's okay for us to say what we need. Oftentimes, yes. You know, we're letting people say all these things, and it's like we don't want to say, well, gee, that's not helpful, but maybe we do need to say those things.
I've gotten bold in that I hope I haven't been rude. I try not to be rude, but I've also wanted to look out for myself because you know what? I've been fragile. I've been torn to the ground with this grief. And there was a man in a grocery store. I'd actually gone to buy flowers to take to my son's grave, and an older man who said he'd been a part of our church for a long time, and I'm sure he was. I didn't recognize him. But he wanted to talk to me, and he wanted to tell me all these things about how sorry he was. And I I'm heading to the cemetery. I can't have a conversation. And I tried to, you know, thank him and, you know, thank you, and move away. And he was not reading my body language. And he actually reached out and took my arm and said, well, there were some other things I wanted to say. And I had that split-second moment of where I was aghast. I was like, are you kidding me? Mm-hmm. You're going to make me stay here when I can't even talk. And the other part of me was like, no, be polite. You're the pastor's wife. And the part of me that was a person first just reached out and gently disengaged his hand from my arm and said, I thank you for your empathy. I can't talk right now. And I turned and I left. The old me wouldn't have done that. The old me would have sat there and let him, you know, tell me whatever it is he wanted to tell me. But the person that I was that was ravished by grief, I couldn't do it.
Well, you were taking care of yourself is what you were doing.
I took care of myself in that moment more than I was taking care of him.
Yeah, and I've had to do the same thing. There are times when I've had to say, look, if you're uncomfortable with me or this, then you need to remove yourself from my presence because I need to be where I am right now.
Yeah.
And that's a healthy thing to do.
People need to have the permission to take care of themselves like that. People who are grieving, we're so used to taking care of other people.
Fixing them.
Or just the polite interactions we do in society and try to be polite with each other. And I'm not suggesting being rude. I don't mean that. I just mean when the grief is so strong, it's okay. It's all right to not observe some of the polite conventions of society. It's more than you can do.
Right.
Some moments.
Traumatic events like these often lead us to a crisis of belief. You pray, you believe God's promises, and the tragedy happens anyway. Were you angry with God?
I think disappointed might be a better way to describe what I felt.
Okay.
I think because we had known for so long that Matthew was living on the edge of taking his life. He had been ill for such a long time, had threatened suicide, attempted suicide before, that we weren't shocked by his death as much as shocked that it happened that particular day, if that makes sense. And so I had had many years to wrestle with the overwhelming fear that my son was going to take his life. So anger wasn't what I felt as much as I felt disappointed. We had prayed, and I had prayed with as much faith as I knew how to muster up. I mean, I was all in believing that God was going to heal Matthew or that he was going to, if he wasn't going to remove the mental illness, he was going to make it so that Matthew could manage it and have a reasonably happy and normal life. I believed it. And when it didn't happen that way, there was the sense of being let down. You know, what good were my prayers? Why did I spend all that time agonizing? Why did I bother to believe? You know, was it a waste of my emotional energy? And I was angry at other people. I was angry at the medical community. I was angry at the misdiagnosis. I was angry at the psychiatrist who abandoned him in the hospital. I mean, I was angry. There was a lot of anger.
Mm-hmm.
But with God, it was more of the disappointment of feeling like I didn't know how else to try any harder, that somehow my effort should have been enough.
Right.
And my belief should have been enough to keep Matthew alive. And it wasn't.
How about trust with God, Kay? Can you trust him?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, absolutely. I do trust him.
What do you think we should expect from God as we walk through this dark night of the soul? Because the formula doesn't always work. I mean, here you prayed, you believed, you had all this faith, you thought, you know, A, B is going to equal C. But that's not how it happened.
I desperately hoped that A plus B would equal C. And it's hard to put into words because it's all still so fresh.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have the vantage point of 15 years away. This has only been 15 months. And actually, today is 16 months.
So sorry, Kay.
I can't even count. Yesterday was 16
yeah, I know,
months.
I know.
But the point is that it's still so fresh, and I'm still learning. I can absolutely trust God because there are things that He understands about this world that I will not be able to see here. I accept that truth. I accept that God's ways are higher than mine. And what seems to be ridiculous and a waste of a life and a waste of my prayer, from my vantage point, I think you could stack that up and say, you know, you've got reason to believe that. But this just isn't a world of the seen. It's a world of the unseen. There are spiritual realities that are at play here, and God is at work in history, and He's at work in Matthew's story. He's at work in my story, in my family's story. And so I can't just base my life on what I can see. I have to base it on what I cannot see. And in the realm of what I cannot see, I do trust that God is working and that God was completely aware of every tear that I shed in intercession, every ounce of faith I have. He was so aware of Matthew's struggles and where his pain was. And in that, because God is outside of what I can see, I do trust. It makes 2 Corinthians 4:16 to 18. It's the reality of that. It's, you know, therefore we fix our eyes not on what is seen, which is temporary, but on what is unseen, which is eternal.
Amen.
That's where my hope is.
I think what you're saying is that you're believing that God is telling a story of redemption. The big picture, God is ultimately telling us a story of redemption through His Son. And in our individual lives, even amidst the ruins, as you've talked about, there's something redemptive. And so my trust is that God, I don't get it. It transcends my understanding, but I'm going to trust that you're in the business of telling a redemptive story in my life. And that's what's going to give me the meaning and purpose to move forward, to be part of that story, because your story isn't finished yet. Neither is mine.
Yeah. When these that we love die in such tragic and horrible, catastrophic ways, it's easy to think that, you know, I remember when when it was confirmed that Matthew had taken his life, we suspected it. And when we actually learned from the police that, yes, he had, I have vague memories of collapsing on the ground in front of his house and screaming, "This is not how it was supposed to end." And from a mother's heart, that is not how it was supposed to end. But it didn't end. And that's where I have to put my focus.
Yes.
Matthew is alive. And the Easter message has meant more to me this year. This was the first Easter since he passed away. And I have to tell you that Easter has been one of those intellectual exercises for me. Christmas is all warm and fuzzy and ooey and gooey, and you've got this whole month, you know, where it's family and carols and food and gifts. I mean, it's such an elaborate part of our American life and even life as believers. But Easter, to be honest, has always been about the lunch. You know, it's, you don't spend, at least the evangelical tradition I grew up in didn't observe Lent. And so it really just came down to, boom, here's Easter and Jesus is alive and let's go have ham and, you know, scalloped potatoes. And for me to understand in a new way and to prepare my soul through Lent and through concentrating on his suffering. But then at the end of the day, he's alive. And 2 Corinthians even says, I mean, that's the reason we have this hope. Therefore, that's why we don't lose hope. It's because Jesus is alive. And because Jesus is alive, Matthew is alive. Yeah. And because Matthew is alive with Jesus, I too will live. And that puts everything in the context. It all truly hangs on the resurrection of Jesus Christ. And if that's true, then we have hope. If it's not true, as Paul says, we're the
to be pitied.
Most pitied of all.
Yes, absolutely. So what you've done then is really focused on to get through the enormity of this pain, the enormity of this struggle, is holding on to the truth that our faith is real, that Christ's sacrifice was real and that this life isn't it, that we're waiting to step through the veil and join those that we love so much.
The only way I can keep going.
I know. You've said your faith won't survive without hope, and hope won't survive without the realization that there are mysteries that will not be answered. If you can embrace both, you can have a vibrant faith. For survivors of suicide, there's so many unanswered questions, so much unfinished business that we have to deal with. How did you make peace with all that's still unanswered for you?
You know, Stephen Curtis Chapman, I'll answer it this way. Stephen Curtis Chapman has written the most beautiful CD that it's comforted me almost as much. You know, people say, have you gotten through? One of the things I refer to is his album, Beauty Will Rise, that he wrote after the death of his little girl, Maria. And it's this raw album that drips with pain and sadness and sorrow, but it also drips with trust and hope and faith. And some of the lyrics that he says, this is not how it should be. This is not how it could be, but this is how it is. And our God is in control. This is not how it will be when we finally will see with our own eyes that he was always in control. And that whole concept of accepting and acknowledging the brokenness, the pain, this is not how it should be. No, Matthew should not have died. He should not have died by his own hand. That is not God's plan for, that was not what God intended for Matthew's life. My feeling of this is not how it should be was exactly right. This isn't how his physical life on earth was supposed to end. But I know that I will see, and I'll see it eventually, and it will become crystal clear. That's what I do with all those questions that are just as profound and just as troubling today as they were, you know, 16 months ago. I still have my little mystery pot that sits next to my Bible on my devotional table. And every time a new question comes up that I don't know how to answer about God, about his character, about his plan, about the actual things that happened to Matthew, and I don't need to go into all those details, but the questions that are concerning his death and what was he thinking before, and I just keep throwing them in that pot with the absolute certainty that God will answer them. They will not remain unanswered questions. They will not remain mysteries to me. The mystery will be solved. The mystery will be resolved. I'll get it. It will make sense to me. I mean, Matthew's life makes sense to him now. He completely understands his own life, the things that troubled him. It all is resolved. And so I cling to that same belief that those mysteries, as troubling as they are for me now, will be resolved. And they'll be resolved by a God I can trust. They'll be resolved by the God that I have placed my own life in his hands.
That's powerful. I love that idea of the mystery pot. I love that.
Well, I have it sitting right next to a box that says hope on it. Because in the hope box are verses that are helping me rebuild my hope and my faith after they were shattered. After believing with all that I was that Matthew would be healed and then he wasn't, and I said I was disappointed, I had to rebuild my hope. So I took out of that hope box the verses that I had been reading and claiming over and over and over for several years for his healing. Because those verses it's not that they weren't true, but they were about living here on this earth. They were about his life here. They were about his ministry here. And those were no longer valid in the same way that I had hoped them to be. So I had to find other verses that allowed my hope to grow again. One of them is 1 Corinthians 15:43. And I say it every time I go to the cemetery and I stand or sit or lay down next to my son's headstone. 1 Corinthians 15:43 says, these bodies are buried in brokenness, but they will be raised in glory. They are buried in weakness, but they will be raised in strength. I can say amen to that.
Yeah.
I can give my whole yes to that. I can put my hope in that what has been shattered and broken and destroyed here and was buried in weakness will be raised in glory and in strength. So I put other verses like that in my hope box, and those two sit next to each other, hope and mystery.
I love that, Kay. What you're doing is you're answering the question, how do we begin to start the process of regaining hope again after such catastrophic loss? Because these tragedies rip our hearts apart. And I think we do have to start that rebuilding process. And that leads me to my next thought. You know, as you talk, I'm so aware of the certainty that you have of God's love and goodness, even amidst this horrific tragedy. And I can echo the same sentiments. When something this tragic happens, something this senseless happens, many people, however, aren't there where we are. Many turn from their faith. Why do you think some people make their way back to their faith after catastrophic loss and other people lose the battle for their hearts altogether?
Well, you know, there's really nowhere else to go. I mean, there truly is nowhere else to go. I could walk away from my faith. I could walk away from hope. But where would I go? I mean, it's not like there's anything else out there that's going to give my life meaning, that's going to give Matthew's death meaning, that's going to give me the hope to get up tomorrow. There's nowhere else to go. And so, honestly, there have been times where I've drugged myself back to my faith or back to the cross with this sort of cynical, resigned, well, where else would I go? You know, I echo the disciples' words to Jesus when he commends them for their faith. They're like, well, where else would we go? So I have tremendous empathy for those who go through a crisis of faith when they've prayed or when they, some people don't even know that, they don't even know that their loved one is thinking about ending their lives. They don't recognize, they don't know that person is suffering until the death happens. And so it's so shocking to lose their loved one when they weren't even remotely anticipating such a thing. And that shock can lead people to just walk away. But truly, there's just nowhere else to go. God is the only one that offers hope. God is the only one that offers a reuniting with our loved ones. God is the only one who promises to bring beauty from the ashes. God is the only one that promises to rebuild the ruins. God is the only one who promises that there will be joy for mourning. There's just nowhere else to go. So as much as there have been times when I was disappointed in God and even angry at him and just to be completely baffled by his ways and by the circumstances that have come into my life, ultimately, I will run to him in my anger, my confusion, my frustration, my pain, my overwhelming sorrow. Psalm 61 says, when my soul is overwhelmed, I run to the rock that is higher than I run to the towering rock when my soul is overwhelmed. Well, my soul has been and is and continues to be, in some ways will always be, overwhelmed by Matthew's death. So I'll run to that towering rock of safety, who is the only one who promises me hope in return.
Amen. I've heard you say that God is not helpless among our ruins, and it was part of a quote from the Olympic athlete Eric Little, and that really ministered to you. What does that mean to you now, 16 months after Matthew's death?
Oh, it just confirmed. It's again, one of those, if Stephen Curtis Chapman's CD, Beauty Will Rise, and Jerry Sitzer's book, A Grief Disguised.
Yes.
Then this quote by Eric Little is one of those, it's in my hope box, because it's not scripture, but it's based on scriptural truth that, yes, circumstances may appear to wreck our lives, but God is not helpless among the ruins. And the quote goes on to say, paraphrase it, he continues to work out his plan of love in our lives. And I could, that's the testimony of Matthew's death, is that it felt like our lives were ruined and shattered and forever destroyed, and that everything was wrecked, really. It wrecked our family. It wrecked our faith temporarily. It wrecked our plans for our son. It wrecked, we're just not the same. I don't like to be in crowds. I mean, so many things are different now.
Kay, you wrote a powerful post on Facebook as the one-year anniversary of Matthew's death approached, and you were addressing the less-than-sensitive things that people sometimes say or expect from those of us who have suffered catastrophic loss and are called to move on so quickly. What do we, as grievers of a tragedy of this magnitude, not need to hear from well-meaning people?
In their attempt to comfort, they inadvertently minimize our pain. So in their attempt to comfort us and remind us of the good things that are still in our lives, they'll use that phrase, at least. And so in my Facebook post, I just ask people to drop that. You know, if you're trying to comfort somebody, drop the at least, because all it does is minimize and try to put somebody else's sorrow and grief into a neat little box that we're more comfortable with, instead of dealing with the raw, ugly truth that loss hurts. They don't mean to, but so just being careful and thoughtful about the at least. And the most tender thing you can say is, I'm so sorry for your loss.
Well, Kay, thank you so much for your time. I know how busy you are, and I'm just so honored that you would take this time out of your busy schedule to just share your heart. And
well, I appreciate the opportunity, first of all, just to, you and I have lost in a similar way. And at the end of the day, there are universal things, there are commonalities in grief, but at the very end of the day, the relationship I had with Matthew was unique. It was different than the relationship Rick had with Matthew. It's different than his siblings. Your relationship with your husband was different than anybody else's, and that makes the grief unique.
God bless you, Kay.
You as well.
Bye-bye.
I had a big hole in my heart, and I was looking.
Thanks for joining me today. If you have a question or comment, or you'd like to be a guest on Heartline, I'd love to hear from you. You can contact me at ritaschulte.com, on Facebook at Rita Schulte LPC, or Twitter at Heartline Pod. And remember, it's your heart. Keep it alive. Check the pulse.